From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we look back on the war and head toward peace and check in with some of the people we've spoken to since the war began. Political scholar Fred Halliday speculates on the future of Saddam Hussein. Arab poet Dabia Khamis explains why the war divided her friends. James Adams, defense correspondent of the Sunday Times of London, reviews the military lessons of the war. David McReynolds of the War Resisters League considers the successes and failures of the peace movement. And political cartoonist Dan Wasserman tells us what's on his drawing board now that the fighting has stopped. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Bush announced today that the Iraqi government has agreed to meet with allied representatives to arrange a ceasefire. He said the Iraqis will select a military team to meet with the coalition commanders. Speaking at the beginning of an Oval Office meeting with Kuwait's ambassador, the president said that the release of prisoners of war will be a first priority. Kuwait's ambassador, Saud Nasser al-Sabah, praised the president as a great liberator and publicly thanked the United States for ending the Iraqi occupation of his country. Since the arrival of Allied troops in Kuwait City, more reports of atrocities committed by Iraqi troops in the days before they fled the city have emerged. NPR's Neil Conan recently visited a hospital in Kuwait City and has this report.
At the main hospital here today, I spoke with several doctors who said that throughout the Iraqi occupation, it was a rare day that three or four bodies weren't delivered, victims of torture or simple murder. Some, they said, had been decapitated. Still in the hospital are 42 Iraqi soldiers. I spoke to a colonel who was left behind in the retreat 2 days ago, then shot by resistance fighters, and to an infantry private shot by his own officers. He and his fellows refused orders to walk from the Saudi border to Basra in southern Iraq, that after other officers had fled with all of the unit's trucks and cars. This is Neil Conan reporting from Kuwait.
Kuwait's ambassador to the United Nations charged today that Iraq may be holding as many as 22,000 abducted Kuwaiti civilians and more than 8,000 prisoners of war. Ambassador Mohammed Abul Hassan said that Iraq has failed to cooperate in disclosing the condition or whereabouts of the missing people. Iraq's ambassador said that his country is ready to repatriate people as quickly as possible, but wants help from the International Committee of the Red Cross. The man who was to have been one of the U.S. government's key witnesses in the drug trafficking trial against Manuel Noriega has died. As Jeff White reports, the facts surrounding the man's death are still unclear.
Ramon Navarro was a convicted drug smuggler, and government prosecutors hoped to use his testimony to link Manuel Noriega to drug trafficking. They also planned to have him testify against two of Noriega's co-defendants, Brian Davidow and William Saldarriaga, at their trial within the next 2 days. But according to local police, Navarro died in a traffic accident late last night. Police have not yet released full details of the accident, but homicide detectives are reportedly investigating the case. Both Davidow and Saldarriaga are on trial right now in federal court on drug smuggling and conspiracy charges. Defense attorneys have said Navarro's death is a major blow to the government's case against the two men and could also seriously weaken the case against Noriega, which is currently scheduled to begin in June. For National Public Radio, I'm Jeff White in Miami.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost just under 7 points to close at 2,882.6. This is NPR News. The European Community has granted $675,000 in emergency aid to help Iraqi civilians recover from the war. The funds were designated for a water purification system and other sanitation equipment to help combat potential outbreaks of disease. The EC's Middle East Commissioner said that the community plans to help rebuild both Kuwait and Iraq. The aid for Iraqi civilians was made in response to a request from the Red Cross. Officials said the EC Commission is expected to approve a $338 million aid plan for Israel tomorrow. Arab Americans are reacting to word of the ceasefire in the Gulf with a combination of relief and sadness. Don Gagne of Michigan Public Radio reports from Detroit.
Metropolitan Detroit is home to 250,000 Arab Americans. Many still maintain that the war was not necessary, but at the same time, they're glad the shooting has finally stopped. 27-year-old Michael Safara moved to Detroit from Baghdad 12 years ago. He had this to say after watching President Bush's speech last night.
It's good news and bad news. Explain.
It's good news that the war has stopped, finally. But the bad news is Iraq been destroyed. And they destroyed Iraq and stopped the war? Is that what they wanted to do?
Safara says there's no need for Saddam Hussein to be removed from office because, he says, he no longer poses any threat. But others who gathered at this Iraqi men's club called Saddam a crazy man who put his own ego before the good of his country. For National Public Radio, this is Don Gagne in Detroit.
The South African government has announced the beginning of steps to bring one of its nominally independent black homelands back into the country. The government said it will appoint four government ministers in the homeland of Ciskei and give the homeland financial, technical, and personnel assistance. Ciskei's military leader, General Opo Kozo, said that the agreement was a first step toward incorporating Ciskei into a new non-racial South Africa. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Now that the fighting has stopped, we wanted to check back in with some of the people we turned to over the past few weeks to help us understand and interpret the war. First, we called Fred Halliday. Halliday is a professor of international relations at the London School of Economics and the author of books and articles on the Middle East and the Cold War. We spoke with him last week about the Soviet Union's attempt to broker a peace settlement with Iraq. Today we asked Halliday about Saddam Hussein's future in Iraq.
Saddam Hussein may have enough power left to survive. He's obviously been weakened by the war militarily. He's lost most of his armored divisions, his air force, his navy, but he retains several hundred thousand men under arms in the north and center of the country. He retains his three security forces. He retains the apparatus of the party, and effective political opposition to him within the country is still punishable with death. Moreover, he will turn the Allied attack on Iraq to political advantage. I don't know how successful it will be. That depends on what happens in the longer run. But he will say, we stood up for more than 5 weeks to the armies of imperialism. We have told the West to go to hell, as no Arab leader has done in this century. And we have championed the cause of Iraqi steadfastness, which is an important virtue in that part of the world. And for those who believe him, the cause of Palestine. So he's not down and out. And if you see how difficult it's been for other dictatorial leaders to be ousted, even when they've made great mistakes, then Saddam is in with a chance. But of course, it's not just the war itself, but the policies which the states around Iraq, all of them around Iraq, will pursue afterwards, which will seek to undermine him.
He really did not do a very good job militarily in this war. Do you think his own military would like to overthrow him, or other people close to him in power? Do you think they would like to overthrow him, and do you think that they will?
Well, Saddam is heartily disliked by most Iraqis. I've no doubt about that, and that's been the case for many years. And many of them will blame him for this war and for what he's brought on them, and the very inept way he's handled not just the war, but the diplomacy. And in some ways, the diplomacy is even more a disaster because he could have avoided it at several times. He could have saved everything and got out of Kuwait, not just up to the 16th of January when the fighting started, but even afterwards. He mistimed everything. The military are organized by the party and by the party leadership, as in a communist country. There never was a coup in a communist country, except perhaps to General Jaruzelski in Poland in 81, and even he did it with the agreement of the party. So it would be difficult for the military to act, but there must be people who will oppose him, and they will know what people in the population are saying. So there is a reasonable probability that at some point between now and, say, the next 2 years, Saddam will be overthrown, but it's not inevitable. And he knows that as well as anybody and will take the necessary precaution.
It seems like it was one of the unstated goals of the coalition forces to get rid of Saddam Hussein. Do you think that they will let him stay in power, after the ceasefire?
Well, I don't think it was so much an unstated goal to get rid of Saddam. It was a logical conclusion of the stated goal. The stated goal was to ensure stability in the Gulf and to reintegrate Iraq into a more calculable and a more reasonable set of regional relationships, particularly vis-a-vis other Arabs. And let's not forget, Saddam's first and last quarrel was with other Arabs, not with Israel, not with Iran, not with Turkey, and certainly not with the United States. So once that was proclaimed by Bush on the night of the 16th of January, the removal of Saddam and his whole regime, or the people around him, was a necessary conclusion. However, it's not within the United Nations mandate. It would involve enormous extra military and political risks within Iraq and outside, and one only has to see how difficult it's been to unseat other rulers for this to be something that must be treated with caution. After all, the Russians tried for many years to get rid of Tito. They didn't succeed. The United States tried to get rid of Noriega. They finally had to go in, tried to get rid of Gaddafi. He's still there. They've tried to get rid of Castro. The mechanics of getting rid of a country, even if you blockade it, if you undermine it, are quite difficult, let alone the patriotic backlash. So yes, getting rid of Saddam is a precondition for meeting one of Bush's war goals. But the United States is not prepared, and wisely so, not prepared to pay the price that would be involved in doing so. However, the removal of Saddam is not just what George Bush would like to see. It's what most people in the Arab world would like to see, those in the government anyway, in Egypt and Syria and Saudi Arabia. They want to get rid of Saddam. So do the Turks. And so, in my view, do most Iraqis. So it's not a question of America versus Saddam, but it's a question of a well-entrenched dictator against a wide range of enemies. And he will bob and weave as best he can to stay in power and stay in this world, for that matter.
So you think he's in for a while?
I'm not sure. And it'll only be clear once the dust has settled. We don't know how many Iraqis have been killed. Is it 2,000? Is it 20,000? Is it 100,000? We just don't know. We don't know how much of Iraqi territory is being occupied. We don't know whether the city of Basra is under foreign occupation or not yet. So how many Iraqis are under foreign rule? Until that is clear, until the extent of the defeat is clear, and it isn't clear yet, it simply is impossible to tell. Secondly, one will have to wait a week or two to see how the regime in Iraq reacts, whether they play down Saddam's role, whether his pictures start coming down, whether it's a tactical retreat or whether it's a sincere one. There's a lot that has to be looked at for a week or two, and then one can see. But all I can say is the pressures on him are great, but he's survived. The fox, as the Arabs call him, the fox has slipped the net again, as he did in the war with Iran, and he may live to fight another day. It's possible. I don't think it's inevitable that he will fall.
What do you think of the coalition force's greatest gain in this war, politically?
Well, all wars are fought on at least two fronts. They're fought against the enemy, and then they're fought to improve their position vis-a-vis their allies. If you remember in the Second World War, the United States and the Soviet Union fought Germany and Japan, but they also improved their position vis-a-vis other countries, the United States vis-a-vis Britain and France and the Soviet Union in Eastern Europe. So the gains of the United States and of Arab countries in this war must be seen in both perspectives. Clearly, Iraq has been dealt a very serious blow and will not, for many years, more than 10 years, I think, be a serious military threat to anyone. And let's not forget the people who are most pleased about that are not the Kuwaitis or the Saudis or George Bush, but the Iranians. They were the ones who suffered most from Saddam. So Iran will feel much more secure, and so will the other neighbors of Iraq. That's number one. Number two, I think the war was in many ways an Arab civil war, the first we've seen in modern times, the first time Arab armies have really fought each other. And clearly the Arab states that fought with the coalition or played a token role, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Syria, and Kuwait, will benefit in terms of the divisions of the Arab world. And the losers, we know who they are. They're the Jordanians, the Yemenis, the PLO, all of whom have legitimate grievances against the coalition states. But those legitimate grievances have been drowned now in this military triumph. The longer-term question is, well, how does it affect the United States' relations with other members of the coalition? With Germany and Japan, with the whole demand for greater financial support, may end up that the United States won't make much money out of this, and even if it does cost them the $20 billion that it's been said to cost them, it's very small compared to the $500 or more billion which the savings and loans disaster is going to cost the United States government. Moreover, the relations of the United States and the Soviet Union have been altered. I think the United States has notched up an even greater degree of advantage over the Soviet Union because it's demonstrated the superiority of its military equipment, which will not be lost on the Soviet military and on Soviet allies the world round, and also because it simply rebuffed the Soviet peace offers. So war is about altering relations between the victor powers as much as it's altering relations between the victors and the vanquished, and the United States will benefit from that latter relationship, the change between the various victors, as much as between itself and the vanquished. In fact, I think most people in the United States are much more concerned about their relations with Japan and Germany and the Soviet Union, all of whom are on the same side, than they are about Iraq, a country about whom I doubt if they care or know very much.
Are there certain pitfalls within the victory for the victors?
Well, wars don't solve anything, but they provide an opportunity to address certain problems. There are several pitfalls, and I am not at all sure that they will be addressed. The first is the pitfall of falling back into the bad old ways of the Persian Gulf. By that, I mean two things. One is accepting the status quo in terms of dictatorial governments, both Iraq, whom the West supported for many years. I think most Iraqis blame the United States for supporting Saddam rather more than they blame the United States for dropping bombs on him, but also the coalition states Saudi Arabia and Kuwait. Now, in human rights terms, there is no comparability between Kuwait and Saudi Arabia on the one hand and Iraq on the other. Iraq has a much, many times worse human rights record. But in Saudi Arabia, no one has a vote. There is no freedom of expression. Women are not even allowed to drive cars. It is a highly authoritarian, religiously and genderedly discriminatory society. Kuwait has a better record, has a decent constitution, but the ruling Al-Sabah family, who are in the main corrupt and inept, they could have avoided this conflict altogether, they are seeking to prevent the restoration of democracy. So the issue of democracy in that area is one that has been avoided and needs to be addressed. But as Arabs say, why should the United States demand democracy in Latin America and Eastern Europe and not do the same in the Middle East? Good question.
Can I ask how you're feeling today on the first day of what appears to be a military victory?
Well, I woke up unusually early at 6 o'clock to hear that the ceasefire had come into play, and I was delighted to hear it. I feel a sense of relief that the war is over. I worry greatly about how many Iraqis were killed. I hope, as I've hoped for many years, it is my abiding sentiment in this whole thing that Saddam Hussein is driven out of power by his own people. And I hope, not with great optimism, that the victorious powers will learn something politically from this war to which they contributed by building up Saddam over the years, by mistakenly refusing to negotiate with Iraq before the war. And I would say that some of Iraq's criticisms of Kuwait were valid. It doesn't justify the Iraq invasion of Kuwait. But I wonder about what's happening. I wonder both about how many Iraqis have been killed, and I wonder what's happening in Kuwait, in particular what's happening to the hundreds of thousands of Palestinians in Kuwait, about whom many people are fearful, and about whom, as of now, 4:30 or 5 o'clock London time, there is no news, and none of the correspondents in Kuwait seem to have made it their business to find out what's happening to them.
You said that you hope the Iraqis are able to drive Saddam Hussein from power. How would they be able to do that?
Well, there are three ways in which Saddam could go from power. The first, which is highly improbable, is to do what Nasser did, and that is to make a speech to the people and offer to resign. Remember, the people sincerely poured into the streets to ask Nasser to stay. But I doubt very much whether Saddam would offer to resign, because he knew the people wouldn't pour into the streets. But that is one way, and let's just mention it in order to exclude it. The second way is for some kind of military or armed action to overthrow him by the armed forces, and the third is for some broader popular and armed uprising to occur, both in the Arab cities and in the Kurdish mountains. The last is improbable, given the balance of forces within the country, but there is a long history of armed uprising in Iraq, particularly by the Kurds and their left-wing allies, and it remains to be seen what happens. I think that if Saddam can weather the next week or two, then it'll be some time before he's overthrown, and I'm not confident he ever will. He's only in his 50s. He might be there in 25 years' time. Who knows? But it's certainly his grip on power will be weakened, and if the full extent of his mishandling of the crisis becomes evident, then the chances of a political improvement in Iraq are certainly there. And my hope throughout this crisis has been, if nothing else, that it will unseat this man, who is, by any standards, one of the most dreadful dictators of the late 20th century. And let us not forget that the people who've suffered most from Saddam Hussein have not been the Kuwaitis or even the Iranians, but have been the long-suffering people of Iraq itself, who've had him in power for 22 and a half years.
Fred Halliday is a professor of international relations at the London School of Economics. He spoke to us from London. Coming up, we talk again with Arab poet Dabia Khamis. First, a short break. This is Fresh Air. Over the last few weeks, we've asked many people to share their emotional and political responses to the war. On today's program, we're phoning some of them again, this time to get their reactions to the end of the fighting. In the first week of the war, we spoke with Arab poet Dabia Khamis. She has the distinction of being the first woman imprisoned for her dissident writing in her country, the United Arab Emirates. She was living in Cairo when we first caught up with her. But a couple of weeks ago, she returned to the United Arab Emirates to visit her parents and get a closer look at the situation in the Gulf. When we spoke in January, she was heartbroken by the start of the war. She has friends in Iraq and Kuwait. She was in much better spirits when we spoke earlier today. She told me people were celebrating in the streets.
People are extremely happy, and they are relieved at last. Of course, there is this moment of suspicion. They suspect that Iraqis will not really be committed to what they have said that they will be committed to. They are afraid of revenge, but at the same time, they feel peace at last because in spite of the news that the Kuwaitis and the Allies were winning, people here were really very nervous because of the Scud attacks in Doha, in Bahrain. And I think many people are looking forward to going back to Kuwait or to from the Emirates side to visit the Kuwaiti friends there. And also they are looking forward that after the war there will be changes here in the Gulf, probably more democratic changes, probably more liberal atmosphere in every aspect.
Now, the last time we spoke to you, at the very beginning of the war, you were in Cairo. Is the popular reaction to the war different where you lived in Cairo than it is where you are now in the United Arab Emirates?
I think it's extremely different. In Cairo, during the last 6 months, I have been starting to lose 75% of my friends because a lot of people are extremely sympathetic to Saddam Hussein, unfortunately. And even people who are probably socialist or humanitarian or Democrats, they took what happened in a very prejudiced way. They thought Saddam resembles the Arabs, Kuwait and the Gulf resembles America. And to them, that was a challenge for 30 years of ideas of nationalism, of socialism. And so even people who used to criticize Saddam Hussein in the past started talking about him as a hero, as a national hero. And that, I think, applies to a lot of the intellectual elites there, the artists, people who are working in journalism. And it seemed funny because it's totally different than the government, than the Egyptian government attitude. And it's also very much different than the street attitude, where simple people were much more sympathetic with the Kuwaitis than the intellectuals or the writers or the intellectuals.
Can you give us a sense of the type of conversation that you'd have with your intellectual friends who were siding with Saddam Hussein?
Well, I have been their friend for a long time, so they know me very well. But when the Gulf War started, and even before that, I think, since the Iraqis entered Kuwait, they started thinking of me as a person from the Gulf rather than as an Arab writer. So when I give my opinion, then I am cornered and labeled as pre-imperialism or labeled as right-wing because they think that if you claim that you are from the Gulf and you are worried about the Gulf and you are against the Iraqis, that means to them that you are fighting for your own system. And that means that you are anti-nationalism, anti-socialism, etc., etc., etc. So the kind of conversations we had were basically, first of all, about the meaning of nationalism and the difference between fascism and nationalism. And secondly, I was trying to clarify to them the history of the Gulf, because a lot of them associate the Gulf with oil, with rich tourists, with first-class hotels, with consumption. And I was trying to explain to them that the Gulf has a different history than the one they have in their mind, that there was a struggling movement in the Gulf for the last 40 years. There were people who were pushing for unions. There were people who are pushing for democracy, for election. And if they have not heard their voices, it doesn't mean that they are not there.
Why do you think that journalists and intellectuals from some Arab countries are have really sided with Saddam Hussein, who is so clearly a tyrant, who has so clearly violated the human rights of his own people?
My answer would be very simple. I think for a lot of people in the third world, not only the Arab world, America had always resembled oppression. It resembled a strong government that would stand up with tyrants. And so this is the stereotype idea in our minds. For the first time in our history in the Middle East, we do see the Americans standing up for the right cause from our point of view and trying to be involved in a just cause without necessarily demanding a payback right away. Many Arabs, not only in Egypt, in Algeria, in Morocco, in Lebanon, perhaps in Syria, in Palestine, have always dealt with America as a pro-Israel, America that had its own experience in Vietnam, America that it had its own experience in Latin America. So it is to them the enemy. It seems to be much more a large enemy in their minds than Saddam Hussein or any small dictator in the area could be. The second reason is that I think Saddam Hussein had gathered around him while he was in, well, he's still in power, but during the last 10 years, through a lot of cultural events, publications, he gathered around him a lot of those intellectuals and poets and writers in conferences that were very regular in Baghdad. So a lot of people feel as if they have adapted to Saddam Hussein, and they feel that if they stood with him, then they don't have really to reveal the mask that they used to wear while they were with him in the past to their own people. If they stood against him now, that means that when they participated in these meetings and wrote all these poems and articles making him as a hero, that means that they were participants in creating that evil. So it's a kind of self-defense, I think.
Do you think that Saddam Hussein's, well, humiliation by the American military is going to change people siding with him? I mean, do you think that the people who stayed with him will no longer be with him because of the outcome of the war?
I think this is his end. I think this is his end, and I hope that it's the end of the Ba'athist party system in Iraq, because the people had paid a lot. And like what he did in Iran, he did the same in Kuwait. He lost so much blood from his own people for nothing. I don't think a nation that has any worry about its future could accept that to be the system or the situation that they would like to live under. So I think it is his end, totally.
Are you doing anything to celebrate the end of the war?
Drinking tea with my friends.
Sounds good.
Yeah.
Poet Dabia Khamis, she spoke to us from the United Arab Emirates. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, we review the military lessons of the war with James Adams, defense correspondent for the Sunday Times of London. Also, David McReynolds of the War Resisters League evaluates the successes and failures of the peace movement during the war. And we see what's on the mind and the drawing board of Boston Globe editorial cartoonist Dan Wasserman. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. At a Pentagon briefing today, U.S. military officials said that getting guarantees on prisoners of war will be a top priority for U.S. officials trying to work out a formal ceasefire with Iraq. The briefing followed a statement by President Bush to the effect that Iraq has agreed to a meeting between Iraqi and U.S. military commanders. NPR's Vicki O'Hare reports.
During the Pentagon briefing, Lieutenant General Thomas Kelly, Director of Operations for the Joint Chiefs of Staff, gave a long list of reasons for Iraq's defeat in the Persian Gulf War. According to General Kelly, Iraq suffered a terrible failure of intelligence. As he put it, the Iraqis lost their eyes and ears on the battlefield. Kelly also said that the Allied air campaign against Iraqi forces was spectacularly successful and that U.S. troops had far superior technology and weaponry. He added that when a fighting force must put execution squads on the front lines to prevent desertion, you've already lost. At the Pentagon, this is Vicki O'Hara.
Officials say that getting U.S. troops out of the Persian Gulf is expected to take months, and most likely more reserve units will be called up and sent in with other troops to help in the pullout. White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater said it took 7 months to get in, and it's going to take many months to get out. The overall plan calls for sending troops home by unit on a first-in, first-out basis. But military officials say a date to start cannot be set until peace with Iraq is certain. On Capitol Hill, members of Congress praised President Bush, military commanders, and U.S. troops for success in the Persian Gulf. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold has more on the story.
There was nothing but praise for President Bush on Capitol Hill today. Members of Congress were anxious to associate themselves with the successes of the last several days, but some cautioned that an even tougher chore lies ahead, assuring stability and security in the Middle East. Others pointed to domestic problems, which have been pushed to the back burner since the Gulf War began. Pointing to economic woes, New York Democrat Charles Schumer said the U.S. should apply pressure on its allies to help foot the bill for the war.
It would be a disaster if we won the shooting war in the Gulf, but lost the financial war here at home.
Lawmakers are considering a $15 billion request from the Defense Department to help pay for the cost of the war, but some are reluctant to grant it without assurances that the allies are also chipping in. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
For the second time in 1 month, gunmen have shot a U.S. military employee in Turkey. In the latest shooting, officials say a lieutenant colonel is in stable condition. After surgery, he had been shot in the head. A group opposed to the Persian Gulf War has claimed responsibility for both attacks. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down almost 7 points to close at 2,882.18. This is NPR News. A temporary ceasefire held today in the Persian Gulf, in spite of some violations reported by the U.S. command. A White House spokesman says that there is still great concern about the next several days. The Saudi ambassador to Washington says an estimated 85,000 to 100,000 Iraqi soldiers were killed and wounded during the fighting, and some 80,000 Iraqis are prisoners. The U.S. command says that there were 79 U.S. military personnel killed in action, 212 wounded in action, and 45 missing in action. 52 Americans are listed as non-combat deaths, and 9 are known to be prisoners of war. Israeli Defense Minister Aaron says that Israel will ask Iraq for compensation for the damage done by Iraqi Scud missiles. Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
Israeli officials estimate that the damage done by 39 Scud missiles will cost more than $100 million to repair. Israel will demand that money from Iraq as war reparations. Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir welcomed the ceasefire, but said Iraq must destroy all of its missiles and non-conventional weapons. Shamir said he hoped the new situation will lead Arab states to make peace with Israel. Israeli President Chaim Herzog said he won't feel the war is really over if Saddam Hussein remains in power. Meanwhile, three foreign airlines will resume flights to Israel, which were suspended before the war. Lufthansa starts again on Friday, and Olympic and Austria Airlines next week. Insurance rates have already dropped, and more airlines are expected to start flying soon. For National Public Radio, this is Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
With Kuwait's government getting ready for a return to the country, the opposition is increasing pressure for free elections and a government that combines all political points of view. There are also calls to have a parliament once again. It was dissolved in 1986. Kuwait was the only Gulf Arab state to experiment with a popular assembly, but it was dissolved when it became critical of the government. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. A couple of times during the war, we called on James Adams to analyze the military strategies used by both sides. Adams is the defense correspondent and associate editor of the Sunday Times of London. We called him again today to look back at the military lessons of the war. I asked him if this was the first war that was decided by air power.
Yes, it is. And indeed, before this war began, there were many who said that air could not possibly do the job, that you had to go through hardened battles with ground forces to have any kind of victory. But the air does seem to have triumphed here, first time ever, and we will, I hope, draw a lot of lessons from that, that air power combined with modern technology and modern weapons can really have a stunning effect on ground forces.
Do you have any idea what happened to Iraq's air power? You know, at the beginning of the war, I think a lot of us thought, well, they've got some secret up their sleeve, they're stashing the plane somewhere, but nothing ever happened.
Yes, so it was a curious development, really. At the beginning, before the war broke out, there was a division in the intelligence community about what they'd do. One faction said, well, what they're going to do is to fight, and as we come over, they will try over a period of weeks to husband their resources but trickle them out against us. They'll lose quite a lot, but they'll take quite a lot of us with them. The other side said, well, what they'll do is husband their resources completely, keep them aircraft on the ground, and then after 2 or 3 weeks, they'll surge them out, fly as many as they can off the ground to attack us so that Saddam could say, look, I've suffered the under the Allied attack for this length of time, and still I can fight on. And he would then try and claw victory out of defeat. In fact, he didn't really neither of those things, in part because of our tactics. We were able to destroy large numbers of airfields and keep them out of action, so he was unable to get aircraft off the ground. And then he chose, because I believe even from once the war had begun, he still didn't understand that he was going to lose. So he chose to take his aircraft to Iran to hide, not to hide them, but to put them in a safe haven so that he would have an air force at the end. But, of course, whether he does or doesn't have an air force is largely irrelevant because he'll have no army with which to go to war. So it was another mistake in a really very long list of mistakes that Saddam and his military advisors made.
What do you think are the most precedent-setting maneuvers of this war, the maneuvers that will really be written about in future books?
Well, what we wanted to achieve from the start was strategic deception, strategic surprise. And to do that, we had to have deception on a fairly major scale. Now, in the air phase, we achieved surprise. Well, there is, as they say, no great surprise about that. But in the ground phase, what happened in the few days preceding battle being joined was really a stunning series of major battlefield maneuvers where in the west, 7th Corps and the British 1st Division moved 200 to 300 miles west of where they had been last seen by the media and the Iraqis. And in the east, the Marines, the U.S. Marines, 1st and 2nd Divisions, moved west in a very rapid 2 or 3 day maneuver to completely change their positions. And at the same time, the sort of reconnaissance operations and signals and everything else that the Iraqis had been picked up continued to happen to pretend that we were where they still thought we were. So when we actually attacked, we came from places that they just didn't believe we were. Now that, in terms of dictating the course of the ground battle, was very important and was an almost unimaginable feat of logistics to be able to achieve that. And then to be able to employ the very rapid maneuver warfare that we are trained to do and do it so effectively was, I think, a real example of how classically to employ very large numbers of forces in a ground environment. And I think if in staff colleges to come, that particular phase of the operation will be studied as a classic of its type.
General Schwarzkopf talked about how deception was one of the most important techniques the military used, and they used deception to offset the Iraqi numerical edge in the ground war. And Schwarzkopf talked about how he wanted the Iraqi army to believe that we were going to conduct a massive amphibious operation, and that that's what was written about a lot in the press. Do you think that the press was used unwittingly as part of the deception campaign?
Oh, no question whatsoever. In exactly the same way as Saddam was gathering much of his intelligence from CNN, so the U.S. military and the Allied commanders understood very well that the media had a role to play in this. Now, they didn't lie to the media and say, we are going to do this. They said, we are practicing an amphibious landing. If you want to come and photograph it, please do. And then they took the media up to the border where the Marines were, and the Marines said, we're doing this, that, and the other. And the media concluded that clearly there was going to be a major thrust north from where these guys were. Now, the media drew the wrong conclusions, albeit they were being led along to draw those conclusions. But that played a very valuable part in deceiving the Iraqis as to what was going to happen. And I cannot criticize the commanders for doing that, because it clearly saved thousands and thousands of Allied soldiers and airmen's lives.
Let me ask you how you felt when you heard that the fighting was over.
Gosh, journalists aren't supposed to have these personal feelings. I thought it was absolutely stunning, actually. I've lived and written with a story and written about nothing else for the last 6 months, and I have never been so closely involved with a story for so long. And I was writing last weekend about very late into the night when the tanks first started going over the border, and it was with both excitement and trepidation, and also a great deal of sadness that this had actually come to pass, because once again Saddam Hussein had simply not understood what was about to be unleashed. And if we had 10,000 casualties on our side, what was certain is that he would have 60,000 or 100,000 on his side. And these poor, ignorant guys sitting out there in the desert being condemned to this dreadful fate was outrageous. So in the end, of course, when victory was achieved, and achieved so fast and with such so few casualties on our side as to be almost beyond belief, I was pretty overwhelmed, I must say. And watching President Bush on the television last night, it was a moment in history, and I felt proud to be married to an American.
James Adams, thank you very much.
Thank you.
James Adams is defense correspondent for the Sunday Times of London. Coming up, we talk with the co-secretary of the War Resisters League. This is Fresh Air. When we spoke with David McReynolds during the first week of the war, he was swamped with phone calls from men and women in the military seeking advice on how to stay out of combat. McReynolds is the co-secretary of the War Resisters League, which he joined 30 years ago. He's a longtime peace activist. We called him back today to get his reaction to the end of the fighting. Before the war started, President Bush said this war would not be like Vietnam. And sure enough, this war was quick, and military victory was decisive. I asked McReynolds if he thinks the war in the Gulf will change American attitudes toward war.
It may well do that, and for the worse. It may suggest to us that the future wars are ones that we can win easily at low cost, without our looking at the fact that if there is a God in heaven, that to that God every life is equally valuable, whether it's Vietnamese or American, whether it's Iraqi or Saudi or Kuwaiti or American. And if we're counting the cost only by the number of Americans killed, we may make the mistake of thinking we can play the game of Panama again, as we did in Kuwait. I'm glad the casualties on our side were low. I know they were very high on the side of the Iraqis. And I tend to look at all the casualties as a total.
How effective do you think the peace movement was during the war?
We failed. I mean, let's accept the reality. I have to accept that reality in order to look at the future realistically. We tried to prevent a war, and we didn't. People died because we were not strong enough as a movement to persuade George Bush to stick to sanctions. And I'm not exempting Saddam Hussein. I look at this as a game of two men who had to prove something and proved it at a terrible, terrible cost to civilian populations. And, you know, all of the money that we spend in Saudi Arabia is money that, in liberating Kuwait, is money that Bush said we couldn't have for hospitals and roads and schools because it wasn't there, but he could find it for that war. So we're paying a price, too.
Do you have any critiques of the way the peace movement worked and the tactics that it used during the short war?
No. I basically am pretty proud of the movement. I think it pulled itself together very well. I think it mobilized extremely quickly. I think some of the national leadership was not as clear as it should have been on the fact that Iraq was wrong to invade Kuwait. I think a few people were so angry at Bush they didn't recognize that Saddam Hussein was a dictator, on a point on which the War Resisters League has been clear from the beginning. But I think the broad range of the movement across the country, from San Francisco through Chicago to Seattle to New York, has been very affirmative, very creative, and not controlled by anybody. And it's been quite clear that the main issue was oil, and that was the wrong thing to send American troops into the Gulf for.
What can you tell us about people who deserted during the war? Did you come in contact with a lot of people who opposed this particular war?
Yes,
were already in the military and deserted?
Yes, we have had to take on an additional military counselor full-time here, a man who was a Vietnam veteran and who also was a deserter from Vietnam. And having seen military service there and knowing what Vietnam was about, he deserted and has been on our staff here counseling military men. There have been a lot of men coming in, dozens of men, most of them Latino and African-American men, but many of them also working-class young whites. There have been a lot coming in who are deserters that we've been talking to and counseling.
What options did deserters have? What are some of the routes that they took to get out of the war?
Their only real option was to say that they were objectors on grounds of conscience to military service. And the military said, why didn't you think about this before you enlisted? You enlisted freely, and having received the benefits of your training, now you've decided that you have an objection to the war. But the answer, of course, is people rarely think about things until they're confronted with them directly, and going into the service, it seemed a kind of abstract thing until it came time for war. And I think that the men who said they would, if necessary, desert or face trial. And there are a number of men now facing courts-martial, or courts-martials, whatever that is, whether it's plural or singular, for refusing orders. These are men of considerable courage who made their choice late, should have made it sooner, and they will now face one of three things. Either they'll face a brig for a court-martial, they'll face prison for deserting and being arrested, or in many cases they are going to win their classification as COs and be given a discharge. Those are the three courses open to them.
I'm wondering if you have more personal confidence in the American military than you had before. And I'm thinking specifically of the very human face that General Schwarzkopf has showed, especially in the briefing yesterday where he talked about how no one will be happier than he when there is a ceasefire. And really, every time he's made a public appearance, he's talked about the tragic cost of human life during the war. And I think it's something you don't always hear from military commanders who are sometimes much more cold and exact in the way they discuss war.
I don't think of the military as the enemy. My father was a lieutenant colonel in the Air Force Army Reserve, and saw active duty in World War II in Japan. In India and China. My grandfather was a lieutenant colonel in the Army, saw active combat service in the Spanish-American War. So I know what military men are like, and they're not the enemy. They're my father and my grandfather. I don't share this disdain of the military. But I also don't think the military is able always to face the human cost, and they use a lot of code words. They talk about collateral damage when they're talking about children that have been blown to bits. I think that's partly because they're human beings and they can't cope with the reality. The people who make the best pacifists, Terry, are men or women who've been in combat. They come the closest to understanding why pacifists are pacifists.
What do you think are some of the unanswered questions that we're facing now?
One of the unanswered questions is what happens in a world where the U.S. has shown such extraordinary military power? Will it now move against Cuba? Will it now move against Yemen? Will the American public support that? Are we going to see a repeat of this kind of thing, Panama, so on, all over the world? What happens when the Cold War ends and we find out there's one strong military power that doesn't seem to have a check on it? That's the first worry in my mind. How do we limit the military power of the U.S. government?
David McReynolds is the co-secretary of the War Resisters League. He spoke to us from his office in Manhattan. Coming up, political cartoonist Dan Wasserman. This is Fresh Air.
Hello, it's Noah Adams, National Public Radio in Washington, with a word about what's coming up on All Things Considered. It's the day after the war is over. We'll have reports from Kuwait City and Baghdad, a military wrap-up from the Pentagon, discussions of Soviet reaction and where does the United Nations fit in, the future of the Palestinians, a conversation about General Norman Schwarzkopf, his experiences in Vietnam and with U.S. forces in Grenada. Also on the occasion of his 90th birthday, a visit to the California home of the scientist Linus Pauling. That's later on All Things Considered.
Days after the war started, we called political cartoonist Dan Wasserman. He was facing the predicament of finding humorous ways to cartoon a war that shocked and outraged him. Earlier today, we called Wasserman again and asked him what's on his drawing board now that the fighting has stopped.
I have a cartoon that I just finished, which is the Desert Storm game show with Uncle Sam being declared the winner and Saddam the loser, and the voiceover coming from offstage says that for our winning contestant, we have an expensive and unlimited stay in the Mideast sands, basking amid ancient enmities, blood feuds, and religious hatred. And Uncle Sam's looking somewhat surprised at what the grand prize has been. I'm doing a cartoon on Norm Schwarzkopf being awarded a special medal by Bush in the shape of a television set for sound bites above and beyond the Call of Duty. I'm working on a cartoon of the Democrats in a foxhole trying to decide whether it's safe for them to reemerge. And then I have one on somewhat repentant arms dealers realizing that they made a huge mistake in arming Iraq so heavily and vowing that they'll never do it again. So they decide in the last panel of this four-panel cartoon that from now on they'll sell to Iran. So I'm picking and choosing here. This is sort of from now to the beginning of next week.
I like them. So what were some of the most controversial cartoons that you did during the war? What got the biggest response, pro or con?
This is actually the same cartoon got the biggest response, both from people who liked it and people who thought it was abhorrent. It was a cartoon called Ground War. And it was a meat grinder with soldiers going in the top and coffins coming out the bottom. And this, I drew it a couple of weeks ago when the predictions were that a ground war would be ghastly. And people either thought it was terrific or thought it was just the most awful thing they'd ever seen. So there was a lot of phone calling and letter writing and by trying to reassure people that this was not something that I desired or thought was funny, but a statement about what I thought the impending horror would be.
Now that it appears that the fighting is over, are there issues that you want to get back to in your cartoons that you've kind of put on the back burner for the past few weeks, focusing on the war?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the war's preoccupied everyone, and dominated the political dialogue in the country. And there are all kinds of issues, both here in Massachusetts and in the country, that are going unaddressed. I mean, one of the things that strikes me is that as a citizen of the capital of the United States, if you live in Washington, D.C., you're about five or six times as likely to die of being shot in the street as you were if you were a serviceman or woman in the Gulf. I mean, there's a sort of degree of violence in everyday life in the U.S. that people were worried about and thinking about and trying to get to the root of before the war started. And it seems to me urgent that we get back to that.
Dan Wasserman, thanks very much for talking with us.
Thanks for calling.
Dan Wasserman is the editorial cartoonist for the Boston Globe. Fresh Air was produced today by Fred Landerl, Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person, with Joan Tuohy and Roberta Shurrock. Richard Parker was our engineer. Fresh Air is directed by Chris Spurgeon. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we ask military historian Sir Michael Howard what aspects of the war he thinks his colleagues will be studying decades from now. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.
FM invites you to a concert by the Celtic-inspired group Night Noise, an encore performance here at the WHYY Forum Theater on Saturday, March 9th. The concert is at 8 p.m. There's one show only, and tickets are available through Ticketron. The number is 1-800-233-4050. That's Night Noise, Saturday, March 9th at the WHYY Forum Theater.
The U.S. says Iraq agrees to ceasefire talks.